This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. On this first day of 2018, we're going to take a look back at the old year and setting our sights on what will be new in the new one. San Antonio Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia joins me in a bit to discuss all of that. But first, I spoke with San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg about this January 1st and his thoughts. It was in 2017 that he decisively won the mayor's office.
Well, I think it was a great year in San Antonio. We've been doing a lot of foundation setting, and amid some challenges that we've had, we've moved forward. We've seen a lot of progress on important issues. My perspective coming into office and the work that we've done has been on the pillars of how do we create a strong city. And so we've been focusing on and working towards building our policies and our initiatives around equity, also focusing on resilience as a community in every way, and then also giving people optimism that, you know, this is a great city. We have all the tools in place to be a premier city in the world, and there's great hopes for San Antonio's future. It's a wonderful time to be in this city.
Can you come up with a kind of a concrete example of something you can point to in 2017, other than your election, shows that San Antonio is moving forward?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the first time in the city's history that we've tackled the issues of our past in terms of socioeconomic disparities and made that a foundation for budgeting and also restoring some of the resilience that we need in the communities. We created a city budget that helps restore infrastructure at a rate that brings back neighborhoods that have been in disrepair for decades. And we also, you know, the first act of the city council under my leadership was to sign on this Compassionate Cities Charter. And that was not merely symbolic. What it means is that we are always looking to, on every decision that we make as a council and as a city, it's to the betterment of all of San Antonio. And we've really established that orientation right from the start from the city. We've re-engaged with the world on issues of climate and science. And as we've done this, we've also worked on the foundations of a strong city in terms of our transportation funding, solidifying our water infrastructure. And we've seen that pay off in many different ways. I mean, within the last 4 weeks, we've seen two of the largest and most recognized corporations in America choose to expand here in San Antonio. And we expect more of that to continue into the new year.
And which of those corporations?
Ernst & Young announced a major division expansion within San Antonio along the I-10 corridor. And then USAA announced up to 2,000 jobs will be expanding a division downtown in San Antonio. You know, other issues that we've been working on have been challenging and vexing for cities across the country, including housing. How do we ensure that there is an affordable supply of housing for San Antonians? And we've seen cities struggle with gentrification and displacement and the lack of affordability as property taxes rise. We've been working on creating a comprehensive policy that addresses those things well ahead of the time it's reached crisis levels as it has in other cities.
So looking to the new year, 2018, what's on your to-do list?
Well, I mean, the most notable is to continue San Antonio's rise in the profile among elite international cities. And the clearest example of that is a recognition of our 300th anniversary. So the tricentennial commemoration, celebration, building effort is going to be, of course, central on a lot of people's minds. We have significant work that is underway on transportation, the future of transportation in San Antonio, from surface and mass transit solutions, but also ensuring that we're investing in a long-term competitive environment for air service. And I'm greatly looking forward to the delivery of a comprehensive and compassionate housing policy for San Antonio. The most important thing we can do as a community, especially one that's growing, is to ensure that people have good quality, affordable housing for the long term. You know, of course, all of this is to build a city that is functional, that's resilient, that's equitable for all people. And that's a city worth investing your time and your energy and your resources into. And certainly that's going to affect our upward mobility in terms of our strength of, and resilience of our economy.
What is the purpose of the tricentennial other than having a party?
The tricentennial is our moment within a generation to really demonstrate why people should care to invest their time, their energy, their families, their resources in our city. If you have a second, I'll just tell a really quick story. There was a woman in my office a few months ago now who described living in the valley in Donna, Texas, about, you know, in the mid-60s, and her parents, her mother, would take her to the post office every weekend to pick up a copy of Express News. And they'd read about this metropolis north on, you know, in San Antonio, and they were preparing for the World's Fair. And so in 1968, her mother got the kids in the van. They stopped in San Antonio and got out the hemisphere, and she told them to view the world, taste the world from San Antonio. And from that moment on, she aspired to move here, to build a business here, to raise a family here, and that's exactly what she did. For me and for so many organizations, there are hundreds of organizations and citizens involved in the tricentennial. That's what it is. It's not a party. It's our way of recognizing and celebrating our history and putting some stakes in the ground in the present to demonstrate to ourselves locally, but also to the world, why we are an aspirational city, why the best is yet to come, and that one of the premier cities in the world is, in fact, San Antonio. So, yes, we will have parties. And we'll have a lot of fun as we do in San Antonio. But the tricentennial is about showing the world and ourselves who we are and why we're proud of our future.
That was San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg. We're going to be hearing from other newsmakers and policy shapers in the hour, talking about their New Year observations. Next, we're joined by Gilbert Garcia, Express News columnist, with his thoughts about 2017.
Well, I think the country has been kind of reeling a little bit since the November 2016 election, and I think we've seen the ripples here in San Antonio. I mean, if you look at it in the decade leading up to this year's municipal elections, we'd had 38 council races where the incumbents were involved, and 35 of those 38 we had the incumbents win. This year we had 3 out of 7 incumbents lose. We had another who had a pretty close call, District 1 Councilman Roberto Trevino. We had an incumbent mayor voted out, which we hadn't had in 20 years in San Antonio. You know, 7 of the 11 council positions are held by new people. So there's the sort of frustration with the status quo that we saw in 2016, and it's we're seeing it play out in different ways in different parts of the country. We're seeing it on the left, we're seeing it on the right, but in San Antonio, there was definitely a sense that people wanted to sweep out the people who were there.
Say it loud, say it clear, refugees are welcome here!
For refugees and Muslims, this crowd chanted support. They held signs that read, San Antonio welcomes all, immigrants are Americans, and impeach Trump. Tom Simmons' placard said, anti-Muslim bigotry is fascism.
I think it's the start of it. I mean, once you start alienating one particular element of society, it just picks up and goes the route Germany went.
There are an estimated 30,000 Muslims in San Antonio, but fewer than 24 attended the rally.
They are threatened every minute of the 24 hours, and that keeps them away.
Habiba Noor said local Muslims have children and spouses who are now banned from entering the United States.
I have an Iranian friend whose daughters are in Iran who were just about to get their visas processed to come, but they cannot come. Families are being separated right now.
Many acknowledge the need to combat terrorism, but Claudia Stokes said Islam isn't the cause.
All religious groups have radical wings. I think that, you know, white supremacy has produced a great deal of terrorism in this country, and I just think that it's a false equation.
No justice!
No peace!
The protesters say they're organizing and plan to fight if President Trump keeps promises to further limit immigration and build a border wall. Shelley Coffler, Texas Public Radio News.
We started the year off
with some protest in San Antonio, not my president protest, and then they kind of went away. And occasionally a flare up over some protest about sanctuary cities or about DACA, but was there a normalization that happened here in San Antonio of just getting used to Donald Trump being in the White House?
I think there was some of that. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, in the weeks after he got elected a year ago, I mean, there were people holding out hope that, you know, electors, you'd have the faithless electors who would vote against him. And there were all kinds of Hail Mary passes being thought about. But, you know, people did, I think, accept to some degree the fact that it's the reality. But even if we're not seeing protests, I do think we are. There is a mobilization that's happening. We've seen this national indivisible movement, and where we have progressive organizations, and that really have taken a lot. They've studied the playbook of the Tea Party movement in 2009, 2010, how they organized, how they were able to get together at and meet at town halls that members of Congress had, and to be really prepared to stir things up. We're seeing that on the left. And so even if we're not seeing the protests, I think we've seen these organizations in congressional districts throughout the country. And it's going to be very interesting where we have Lamar Smith leaving Congress in District 21. We have Will Hurd in District 23, a Republican who's going to face a tough race. Those indivisible movements, those people are really stirred up. And whether they are able to get the turnout or not, that's going to be interesting to see.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about 2017-2018 with Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia. We'll be back in a minute, but first, here's Metro Health Director Colleen Bridger talking about her plans for the new year.
You know, I moved here in 2017. I'm really looking forward to continuing that collaboration to address issues like HIV, of course, tobacco use, infant mortality, and diabetes. I think those are going to be a real strong focus for Metro Health for 2018. And we're going to continue to build on what we learned worked so well with teen pregnancy prevention and use those lessons learned to really tackle those other issues as well.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new calendar, what's on the agenda for 2018. Here's Southside ISD Superintendent Mark Eads.
Biggest takeaway from 2017 as superintendent of Southside ISD, our community has invested in our school district, and our community believes that we're going to make a difference, and that is going to be what's going to help us do it.
Now, this is Robin Harder, president and founder of Women Veterans of San Antonio.
2017 has definitely been a growing year for the Women Veterans of San Antonio. We've added over 300 women to our organization, so now we're almost at 600 now. I'm speechless with the growth that we've had this past year.
And we spoke with Diane Rath, Executive Director of the Alamo Area Council of Governments, ACOG, and she says she's looking forward to big things in 2018.
We have an exciting year in 2018. It will be ACOG's 50th anniversary, and we're having our celebration March 1st, and we're very pleased that coincides with the city's tricentennial, and we are an official part of the tricentennial celebration. So that is a great source of pride when we look upon the legacy and the accomplishments over the last 50 years in this 13-county region.
Back with me is Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia. We're talking about the big changes we saw in San Antonio in 2017. One of the biggest was Ron Nirenberg winning the mayor's office and the defeat of Ivy Taylor.
He worked really hard, and he deserves a lot of credit for his win, but I definitely think this was a race that she lost.
At 7 p.m. Saturday, when the early voting totals were posted online by the Bexar County Elections Office, it was clear that Nirenberg's victory was almost a certainty. And as Election Day ballot results came in, his margin grew, ending the night with 55% of the vote against Ivy Taylor's 45%. The election watch event quickly turned into a party and a celebration. As Nirenberg took the stage to speak to his frenzied supporters, he offered a gracious salute to Taylor.
Well, I first want to thank Ivy Taylor, our mayor, for her years of service. It's not easy to do the work that we do, as any family member can attest. It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, and I want to thank our mayor for the service to our city.
Nuremberg's victory over Taylor was unexpected by many outside of his campaign, and Nuremberg told the gathering that the key to winning was old-fashioned retail politics, which requires sweat, shoe leather, and talking to people one-on-one.
This campaign was run at the doors. This was run on the phones. This was run door-to-door to make sure that every San Antonian got a chance to bring their voice to the table. And tonight, to the voters, they got it right.
Prior to Mayor Nuremberg entering the race, I mean, I heard from, there was a prominent political figure from San Antonio, who I think was supportive of Ron Nuremberg, who kind of suggested to him, you know, maybe you shouldn't run, that, you know, in reference to Ivy Taylor saying, well, you know, she hasn't really screwed up enough to get voted out. And, you know, there really were no, you know, huge problems in San Antonio at that point. There were no big scandals involving her. What I think was interesting is it was such a fascinating example of someone who didn't really have a political base anymore. I mean, I think conservatives were not real enthused about her, and I don't think that people on the left were ever going to forgive her for some of the things she had done.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Take another quick break, but first let's hear from County Judge Nelson Wolf about the changing of the year.
2017 was a good year, and we look forward to hopefully our most exciting year, which will be the coming of our 300th anniversary. Looking forward to a number of events we'll be doing during that year. We got a lot of exciting things looking forward. We hope to begin work on our children and women's hospital next year. We're going to be opening two new sheriff's substations and finishing 1604 West. So there's a lot of good positive things I think that will be happening next year along with our celebration of our 300th anniversary.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's natural on the first of the year to reflect on the past 12 months and set targets for the next 12. Here's SA 2020's Molly Cox.
2017 for me was, at least locally, a space where I saw, I believe, our community re-engage, and that was really cool. What I think we have to pay attention to with the tricentennial, it is a space for us to be celebratory. We're an amazing city, and we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do to get to the city that we say that we want, to be a better community. And while we have come a long way, we still have so much more to go. And I think it's important to do both of those things at the same time. How do we celebrate and double down on areas that need our attention?
Ramiro Cavazos of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce predicts that 2018 will see San Antonio continue to support its new push for equity in the economy.
Well, I believe overall 2017 was an exciting year for many reasons. It's hard to say if it was a good year or a bad year, but it was in San Antonio. It was exciting is that change was the common factor, the fact that we are seeing in the recent days the transparency of an open discussion on gender equity in the workplace. Big changes also need to continue to provide balanced growth in San Antonio, and great news seeing a company like USAA bring 1,500 new jobs to downtown. I see that as exciting for having more housing in the inner city and less of a focus on tourism and hotels. And it's a downtown that's going to be for everybody in San Antonio.
Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia is here with more observations of the last year and looking forward to the party primaries set for March 6th.
As far as San Antonio, we've got District 23, really the only consistent swing district in the state of Texas.
The border district, the one that goes from San Antonio down to Del Rio and sweeps over to almost El Paso.
It does. It's one that for several years, from cycle to cycle, we would have it go from Democrat to Republican and back. Will Hurd, who's the Republican congressman who represents that district, has won two in a row. He's going for his third term. I think he's going to have a tough time, but we don't know who he's going to be running against. And the candidate that has probably gotten the most attention is Jay Huelings, who was a federal prosecutor. He actually handled the Crystal City corruption case that has gotten a lot of attention.
The
James Jonas case. And that was actually the last case he handled before he resigned to run for Congress. He's a law school classmate of both Joaquin and Julian Castro. They're very supportive of him. Really, really bright individual. This is the first time he's run. He's Latino on his mother's side, but his last name is Huelings, and we know it's a majority Latino district, and identity politics comes into play. So it'll be interesting to see how all that shakes out. You know, so we don't know who's going to be the nominee on the Democratic side, but that's going to be a very close race, and I think Will Hurd is going to have a tough time holding on to that seat if the blue Democratic wave that many people anticipate ends up happening.
The other interesting primary is going to be who's going to inherit Lamar Smith's seat.
Yeah, it's true. We have there, you know, I think there are close to 15 people on the Republican side. We've got some interesting candidates on the Democratic side. You have Joseph Kopser from Austin, who's had a tech company, who is a military veteran, kind of a centrist on the Democratic side, kind of a centrist Democrat who has been, I think, will be an interesting candidate to watch. But on the Republican side, you've got a lot of candidates. We've got people like Robert Stovall, the Republican Party chairman, who he gave up that position to run for Congress. And the thing that is a challenge for any candidate there is that you've got, it's a district that's pretty much split between parts of San Antonio, the Hill Country, parts of Austin. There is no one candidate that is maybe going to be really well known to people throughout that district, but it's going to be interesting. You've got one of the candidates in that race, Chip Roy, is a former staffer for Ted Cruz. He's going to probably have some Ted Cruz money and an endorsement there, but he's not known at all. There was a recent poll taken by a Republican super PAC just to kind of evaluate the Republican side of that race. And Kiko Canseco, who will probably deal with a lot of carpetbagging issues because he used to be the congressman in District 23. He flirted with running against Joaquin Castro in District 20 a few months ago. And then when Lawrence Smith decided to retire, he just jumped over to 21, which he does not live in. And
you don't have to live in the
district. You don't have to.
Because Will Hurd doesn't live in his district.
Yeah. So but Kiko Canseco has really been jumping around over the last few years. And but in this recent poll taken by a Republican super PAC, he was at 22% and leading the field. And I think it's purely because of name recognition. So what I hear from people, you know, off the record who are working with other campaigns, they'll say they hope that they can get into a runoff with Kiko Canseco. They want to make the runoff and they hope it's with him because they figure that name recognition will carry him to a runoff. But if you get him one-on-one, he's beatable for a variety of reasons, among them the fact that he's probably going to be seen as a carpetbagger.
Well, you have Lupe Valdez.
Yeah.
She's the Dallas County Sheriff, mm-hmm. or at least she was, mm-hmm. To run for governor of Texas. And there's some hope that she's very well known mm-hmm. in the North Texas area.
Yeah.
And that may prop up more seats, bring more people to the polls in that area, mm-hmm. or maybe in other parts of Texas, heavy Latino. Maybe that will shake things up.
Yeah, as a statewide candidate, I mean, she's, you know, somewhat of an unknown quantity, but I think that she's a stronger candidate than Democrats were looking at a few months ago. I mean, there was really a question.
If anyone was going to step up, who wants to be the sacrificial lamb
yeah.
against $40 million in Greg Abbott's war chest?
Exactly. And of course, we heard a lot this year about both of the Castro twins from San Antonio, both Julian Castro, who's you know, the former mayor and former HUD secretary, and Joaquin, the U.S. representative. Both of them, I think, had and as the year went on, I think we heard this more about Joaquin. We had people encouraging him to run for governor because, I mean, this is what it's a song we've been hearing in the Democratic Party in Texas for a few years. I mean, that one or Castro or another could be a difference maker in a statewide race like that.
Yeah, but they didn't run.
Right.
And so I understand that there's going to be aversion to risk when you have you know, that Joaquin would have to give up his congressional seat
yeah.
to run. That's a lot to ask somebody. And but Julian doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I think for him, you're looking at it and, you know, there's a strong likelihood that he's going to run for president in 2020. And I think that what happened is that he looked at the way Donald Trump sort of changed the calculus in presidential politics. And I think people started telling him, well, look, you know, it used to be you had to climb the ladder in a certain way to get to the presidency. And it's not that necessarily true anymore. And so in a sense, I understand that if you're in his position, you're looking and thinking, it's an extreme long shot for me to get elected governor of Texas. And if I lose, and especially if I lose by double digits, you know, where do I go from there? You know, you're politically, you're damaged goods. On the other hand, if you just run for president and there's no dishonor in running for president and losing, and many people have run 2-3 times before they got there. So,
or they ask Rick Perry, there he is,
yeah,
in the Department of Oops. And, you know, he's the energy secretary, and he does.
Maybe there was dishonor in the way he lost in 2012, but you know, generally, I mean, put it this way: if Castro ran in 2020, you know, acquitted himself well in the debates and so on, you know, that puts him in position maybe for a VP slot.
Yeah, is he really running for president, or is he running for VP cabinet post?
He would say president, but you know, maybe running for president with an eye on VP.
And now we're seeing things like Alabama with Doug Jones, mm-hmm, and other special elections across the country. And there are signs that 2018 is going to be a historic year at the polls.
Well, if you're Beto O'Rourke, and let's say he pulls off this huge upset and wins, I mean, he instantly becomes one of the biggest stars in the Democratic Party nationally, because to break the you know, losing streak of what is it, 20,
right,
it'll be 24 years next year, you know.
Suddenly you're a golden child.
That's an amazing, and if one of the casters had been able to do that, I mean, and that, you know, they're already pretty prominent names in national Democratic politics, but yeah, it's going to be a huge thing. So,
well, we'll just have to wait and see.
That's right.
We're taking another break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM, talking with Gilbert Garcia about the year in politics and what might happen in 2018. When we come back, we look at some of the biggest stories of the last year. Before we go to break, this is Graciela Sanchez of the Esperanza Peace and Justice Center.
What I hope about 2018 is that concern about economic inequality is something that pulls us together to work towards a better future for everyone, not just for me, myself, and I, not just for my community, but for all our communities. I also think that at the local level, with new leadership like Ron Nuremberg, part of his vision was talking about inequality, and that we do live in one of the country's most economically segregated cities in the nation. So how do we resolve that? So it was a start to talk about looking at the city budget and talking about inequality and how funding has taken place over not just the last 10 years, but over the last 300 years, to see that, you know, certain areas of the city are really in need of lots and lots of more funding and support to pull them out of poverty. It's a baby step, but I'm excited that not only are we talking about it at the city level, but the county level, and I think nonprofits and foundations, everybody's talking about it.
And let's check in with Drew Galloway, the executive director of Move San Antonio.
Looking back at 2017, what I take away as executive director of Move San Antonio is that this was a year of really high civic energy all across the city, the state, the nation. Young people are paying attention and are looking to do something, whether that is go out and protest, register voters, go out and vote. I think we saw that in San Antonio's municipal election in 2017, where we saw a 300% increase in youth voter turnout. I think Move San Antonio and myself are looking forward to harnessing the power of the youth vote. You know, we've got two big elections coming up this year. That's the March primary election, the November general election. So I believe that we're looking for young people to continue exercising our voice at the ballot box. And then also, I'd love to see 2018 be the year of millennial civic leadership. I think we're seeing more and more younger candidates run for office across the state, across the city. And so I'd love to see more young people grab the helm and run with it.
Welcome back to The Source, Year in Review on January 1st, 2018. I'm David Martin Davies. Express News columnist Gilbert Garcia is here with me to talk about the top stories of the past year. Looking back at San Antonio's 2017, we had some strange stories to report that didn't impact people's lives. There's a new local area code, and there was a gas panic. Here's how TPR reporter Paul Flav reported that story.
Dozens of cars wrap around the building at a local HEB as people wait to fill up on gas. Down Wurzbach at the Shell station, lines pour into the I-10 frontage lanes and staring traffic. Pictures on Facebook of queuing cars and stations without gas have sent thousands of San Antonians scrambling to fill up.
They're just going paranoid. They think we're going to run out of gas. I mean, they're running out everywhere.
Daniel Hernandez, a local cook, has been waiting about 10 minutes and has about 20 more minutes to go. A call from his wife had him leaving work early.
Well, my wife told me the Walmart by our house on Bandera, Gilbo, they ran out right when she was next in line. 7-Eleven ran out.
After traveling to two stations unsuccessfully, Cindy Rearco has been waiting 30 minutes to hear this sound.
And you just finished filling up. How did that feel?
Oh, it felt great.
She says she got a text from her daughter that places were running out.
Because I'm afraid if I waited till 4 or 5 o'clock, maybe there wouldn't be any, so.
Head of communications at HEB, Dia Campo, says Texans should not panic.
The state of Texas will experience some short-term and sporadic gas outages throughout the state. Every gas retailer will be impacted.
She says there's a temporary supply and demand issue stemming from the devastating floods in Houston. People should expect continued sporadic outages.
There will not be outages at every single gas location. If there's a gas outage at one location, I would try something down the street. I think it's going to be pretty unpredictable and sporadic, but definitely not anything that's long-term.
HEB and other providers are replenishing their supplies as quickly as they can, she says. Paul Flav, Texas Public Radio News.
If everyone in the city had simply taken the position that the gas is coming, it's just going to maybe take a little bit longer because of the issue with the hurricane, and if everyone had just said, you know, I'm okay for a few days, but there was this apocalyptic sort of mindset that, you know, this is going to be the last time that we're ever going to get a chance, and so I'm going to wait. And we were about a step away from being in a Mad Max movie.
But still, you said the only tools that we had to deal with the gas shortage was trying to talk people off the ledge, and that didn't work. That just kind of seemed to make it worse. So I'm wondering if there's actually a plan in place to say, what do we do next time this happens?
It's true. And I mean, there's much that I love about the city, but I don't think that period of a few days was necessarily the city at its best when you saw people hoarding.
Other big story of the year, you know, was we lost Dr. Romo at UTSA, and he was fired for hugging too much.
Yeah.
And his firing, we learned about it on Valentine's Day, as a matter of fact, and it seemed like a foreshadowing this
Absolutely.
National thing that we have now about inappropriate conduct.
That's right. I mean, when his story broke, I mean, this was a few months after Roger Ailes at Fox News and the accusations against Donald Trump and so on, but it was a few months before this Me Too movement, which I think really was kickstarted by Harvey Weinstein, the film producer, and the history that he had.
But this was before all that.
It was before all that, yeah. And so it was strange because he had already announced that this was going to be his last year.
Yeah.
And then he got, you know, pushed out a few months early. And I think that you know, every one of these situations that we've seen, and we've seen so many people in the public eye, in the media, in film, in politics, who have been affected by these scandals, but I, as different as they all are, I think one of the consistent things is that it's left people, in the case of Dr. Romo, just wondering, like, what sense do we make of his history? This is someone who was, I think he was at UTSA for about 18 years. I think you got someone who really did a lot to elevate the profile and build that university. There's such a discordant note there at the end.
So another story of San Antonio, the Confederate statues came down, at least the one downtown at Travis Park.
Mm-hmm. Now we're
Confederate, American, and Texas flags decorated one corner of Travis Park as around 250 people, some armed with long rifles and other firearms, sang the Song of Dixie. Paul Grambling is a commander with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. He came to protest from Shreveport, Louisiana. He says Confederate monuments across the country are war memorials and symbols of heritage.
They were put in spots where they are to remember and memorialize the dead soldiers, our dead men who didn't come off the battlefield, who never made it home. That's what these monuments are for.
The protest was organized by a group called This Is Texas Freedom Force. It was a response to request by San Antonio Council members Roberto Trevino and Cruz Shaw to relocate the monument, possibly to a museum. The tall obelisk-like monument features an unnamed soldier at the top. It was erected in the late 1890s by the Daughters of the Confederacy.
What are we here for? Take it down!
Across the park, another 250 people held a rally of their own in support of removing the monument. Jonathan David Jones is a community activist and often participates in Black Lives Matter events.
This monument should have been gone a long time ago, needs to go now. We don't care what they do with it, where they relocate it. They can throw it away. They can put it in one of their homes if they want, but it doesn't belong in public space.
He says the Confederacy stood for white supremacy.
They say it's for heritage. You know, they say it's for history, but we know what it's really about.
On the removal side, Bexar County Commissioner Tommy Calvert says this country tore itself apart over the institution of slavery.
We stand together, united, black, white, brown, gay, straight, of every color, Native American, to say, this is our country. We're united. We're together. We love each other. We don't want to hurt each other. We want everybody to prosper. This is our America. Yeah. And we're not going back.
Joy Palacios, Texas Public Radio News.
Are there still repercussions from that? Are people gotten over that? Is that going to be a thing? You know, is seen as something that Ron Nuremberg did once he got into office. That's one of his first things.
Yeah. And of course, there were some people upset about it. But I think that this is, you know, you'd had a couple of weeks before that, you had the incident in Charlottesville, Virginia, where you had white nationalists with torches going down there. And
a woman die.
Yeah. You had someone just in a car, a white nationalist, basically plow into someone who was a counter-protester, people protesting against the white nationalists. So I think that it was such an ugly scene there that I think that it shook people and changed the debate. This is just, you know, the period that we're going through where I think that people have the things that were in front of us for a long time, people are now looking and saying, it's not acceptable.
It's the Lavernia ISD scandal, and that was student athletes, sexually assaulting and hazing other athletes. These are the allegations. Nothing's been proven in court yet, but we've seen expulsions and we've seen charges brought up, and it really shook up a town, not just outside of San Antonio. And you're wondering, you know, what happened out there?
Yeah, I mean, the allegations that we've heard are really shocking. The stories have been that when athletes went from junior varsity to varsity, there was what I guess the varsity students athletes would call hazing, but these were, you know, really violent sexual assaults, as they've been described. What people define as hazing, which is a euphemism for some really horrible behavior. I mean, this has been a problem at college campuses, and at high school campuses. It's something that it should have gone away a long time ago, as far as I'm concerned.
Another case. Court case that we're following closely this year will be what happens with nurse Janine Jones, who's also known as the Angel of Death. Jones was a pediatric nurse at the Bexar County Hospital in 1981 and 82, where she was suspected of secretly injecting babies with fatal drugs. It's alleged that she killed up to 60 infants. When she took a job at a Kerrville pediatric clinic, the pattern of deaths continued, but there the authorities took action. She was convicted of the murder of 15-month-old Chelsea McLennan and given a 99-year prison sentence. But due to mandatory probation, Jones is set to be released in March.
Bexar County District Attorney Nicola Hood, speaking on TPR's The Source, said he's working to keep Jones behind bars by convicting her of four other child murders from her time at the Bexar County Hospital.
The idea of a serial killer getting back on the streets and not being held accountable for many, many deaths, I think it shocks people's conscience.
But the new effort to convict Jones faces a major challenge because of the actions decades ago by the Bexar County Hospital. Reporter Peter Elkin covered the Jones story for Texas Monthly and wrote the book, The Death Shift, Nurse Janine Jones and the Texas Baby Murders. He said the hospital was engaged in a cover-up.
They had every reason to notify the authorities and failed to do so. And in fact, even when the news broke in Kerrville that a child had been harmed under her care, that other kids had been hurt under her care, that the pattern had resumed, the pattern they knew about. They had a hospital committee meeting with top-level doctors, and they were discussing what to do about this. They decided not to come forward with what they knew.
The DA's office says Bexar County Hospital destroyed medical records which could show how Jones caused the deaths of children under her care. Literally tons of paperwork was shredded while it was under a court order to be preserved. Assistant District Attorney Jason Goss.
You know, as far as the destruction of the records, you have 47 to 60 babies, and I think that we're pretty confident that we're not going to be able to bring 47 to 60 cases. For that reason, if we had the medical records of these children, I think that that would be a different proposition. But my understanding, after the DA got done with the investigation, gave a lot of these records, the hospital records, back to the hospital, and they were in the process of civil lawsuits and some other things going on, and those were destroyed. And I know that because we've tried to get them, and they're gone.
Do you think everyone by now knows, when you say Janine Jones, that registers with them, who that is here in town?
You know, I think that it was a story that was, it was a sensational story in the 80s. I think there are people, many people who don't, who are not as familiar with it now, but it really is a remarkable story, and I think what we're looking at here is the District Attorney Nicola Hood, who sees Janine Jones on the verge of being qualifying for release, and not wanting her to get released. And while the District Attorney would never concede this, I mean, it could be a case where he's doing what he can to just try to kind of stretch out her time in custody while these cases play out. And I think it is doubtful that there's going to be enough evidence here, given
to convince the jury beyond the reasonable doubt. And let's talk about what happened with Harvey, Hurricane Harvey. San Antonio, we almost got hit with 30 inches of rain in one day, which would have been catastrophic for the city.
I mean, we were just basically like a few miles away from really, bearing the brunt of it. And I think that it certainly shook up the people in this community. And this community was affected also in the sense that we had a lot of people coming in from Corpus Christi and elsewhere. We're staying here. We're finding refuge here.
Inside this middle school shelter, dozens of people sit on cots, including parents with children. Small bags of personal belongings line rows between beds. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says the city is expecting to open more shelters.
This is a staged and coordinated effort to relieve the victims of the hurricane along the coast. We're still getting people who are evacuated out of the coastal areas.
Nancy King evacuated from Aransas Pass with her boyfriend and three dogs. Once they arrived in San Antonio, her boyfriend began to have seizures.
By having stress, and he was having one right after another, so they took him to the hospital.
San Antonio's shelters are prepared to be open for days or even weeks if necessary with the help of the Red Cross. Joy Palacios, Texas Public Radio News.
The question that we're going to have going forward is, we dodged a natural disaster bullet this time. Obviously Houston and other communities weren't as lucky, but what will San Antonio do? How prepared will we be in the event that we do get affected by it more strongly?
Obviously, if we get hit with 30 inches of rain, there's little you can do about that. We're going to have flooding. But how bad will it be, and how soon can we recover, and what resources will we have ready to deal with these large natural disasters? That's where planning and city management really comes into play, and dedication of resources. We do know now that these things will happen. Mm-hmm. It's not just a question of if, it's not a fantasy. The San Antonio is in the zone of a natural disaster, and we have to
think about that.
Yeah, and we saw with Houston that, I mean, there are natural forces that you can't control, but within the city, in the case of Houston, there's also been a lot of development that happened in that city in places that were vulnerable, that didn't have to happen, and that have put that city in position where this just keeps coming up over and over again.
Certainly the biggest shocker story, the one I think, while it didn't happen directly in San Antonio, people in San Antonio felt an enormous amount of grief and for what happened with the people in Sutherland Springs, just outside of San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. This is such a small community. It's only a few miles away. And I think the idea that you had people at that First Baptist Church who were, the idea that someone could come in and intrude on a church service and that kind of violence could erupt in a community that's so quiet. I think it was obviously shocking for them, but I think that for people in San Antonio, as you said, it's something that we really feel very deeply here too.
May the Lord give us peace.
Yes, thank you.
Comfort.
Hours after the prayers of Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church were cut off by gunfire, members of the community gathered by candlelight. They wanted to complete those interrupted prayers and find strength and answers in their faith.
Father God, we ask that you heal our broken hearts.
Yes.
The vigil was held across the two-lane Highway 87 from the church that is now an active crime scene. Like many attending the vigil, Joyce Emily stood holding a candle with tears streaming down her cheeks. She said she was familiar with the church and its members.
Actually, we used to go to this church till God led us in a different direction. So,
okay. What was that church like?
It was very family-oriented, and when you walked in, you knew where you were loved.
I certainly want to acknowledge that in 2017 that we had loss of Officer Moreno on the San Antonio Police Department when he made a traffic stop near San Antonio College, and also we lost firefighter, San Antonio firefighter Scott Deem. But wrapping up, looking forward to 2018, this is going to be the year of San Antonio's tricentennial.
I don't know that the city has really defined what tricentennial is supposed to be very well. I mean, if it's, you know, just a series of events that are a little extra special because it's the 300th, I don't think that's real satisfying. I don't, if it was about trying to have a one-year promotional campaign for the city to get the word out to other places about San Antonio, I don't know how effective that's going to be. So it really isn't clear to me exactly what we're trying to accomplish with it. I don't necessarily think it's, I don't have any real negative thoughts about the idea of it, but I just don't think it's ever been clear to me what we're trying to accomplish with it.
All right. Well, I think it's up to all of us. I mean, you have a column. You can write whatever you want. Gilbert Garcia, the San Antonio Express News. I have my canvas here at Texas Public Radio. We're certainly going to be doing our tricentennial minutes throughout the year, trying to highlight some of the more interesting events in the city's history and showing everyone that it's a complex history, it's a complex journey. It's gotten us to where we are now, so it can't be that bad.
Right.
But I want to thank you for joining us on this source as we talk about looking forward to 2018, looking backward 2017. Gilbert.
Thank you very much.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.